Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer Snetter, just talking to teachers.
Ready and raring to go headlong into a new term. And this week sees the welcome and the return of the popular TDT section. And we have Bethan Hindley and Polly Butterfield Tracy joining us to talk about pedagogical coaching. So looking forward to that. We also have a Twixmas interview with Matthew Evans, who was in superb form, which is just as well, as yours truly was a little too full of Christmas pudding and not making a great deal of sense. But Matthew guided me through expertly, so thank you to Matthew for that. We also have an extended podcast pedagogy section where I review my current non-education read, that's Lowborn by Kerry Hudson. And I also take a detour into music and cinema to share some of the things that I and others have enjoyed recently and to show that teachers have lots of other interests in our lives. So it's down the lines of teacher hashtag five a day. And we finish off with some shameless plugs for a couple of brewheads, the South Shore Academy Teach Meet, of course, and the Research Eds in Birmingham and Blackpool coming up. And I'll also share a recommendation for the website Fiverr, as recommended to me by Benjamin D. Barker of Team Science. So, as it is, run every day January. Lace up those shoes and head out into the day or night, or simply prepare to navigate the commute with another Nailers Natter in association with the Teacher Development Trust and Matthew Evans. Okay, so hello, Matthew, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, yeah, nice to be here.
Yes, and we're in Twixmas, I think is the new expression I've heard for this sort of waste ground between Christmas and New Year.
I think we're all wondering whether we should be doing work or drinking and eating more, aren't we? And I've sort of gone for the latter.
Well, that's it, yeah. So this is kind of work, I think. So we can do this with some cheese and some wine and everything else. It's fantastic. So picture the scene. And people will be listening to this probably in the first or second week back at school. So they'll be harking back to those great days of relaxation over Christmas. But thanks for being on at this time of year. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
So we're here to talk about your book, Leaders with Substance, which is an Amazon bestseller, as well as many other things. But before we get into talking about that, could you just tell us a little bit about your sort of journey to this point and how you came to write this book?
Okay, so I've been teaching for 25 years, I think, coming up this summer. And I trained originally at the University of Brighton as a business studies teacher a long, long time ago. And since then, I've worked in six different schools, all secondary comprehensives, different parts of the south of England, starting off on the south coast in quite a deprived coastal school, and then working at a boys' school, a girls' school, mixed comprehensives, all sorts of places, really. And then I became a head of business and economics, which was a job I really loved and did for about 5 years. And then about 15 years ago, I got promoted to senior leadership in a school as an assistant head teacher, and I've been working sort of through different roles up until this point. I became a head teacher back in 2013 at the school I'm currently at, which is in Gloucestershire.
Fantastic. So lots and lots of things to talk about there as we go through the podcast. But the focus is really going to be, like I said, on the book and on leadership sort of more widely. So if we get into the book, and at the start of the book, you talk about something that really resonated with me. You put, despite the millions of words written on the subject of leadership, do we consider leadership to be even a thing?
Yeah, it was a bit of a controversial way to start the book, I guess. But it was my thinking when I started writing in the first place. That was my starting point, my first question, really, because I've spent quite a lot of time in my career reading about leadership and management, studying it, talking about it, doing it in the more recent history. And one of the things that strikes me is that no one really agrees what leadership is. And when I started looking into it, I found that there were lots of definitions of leadership out there. But none of them agreed with each other. There was some overlap in some of the definitions, but not really any certainty about what leadership is. And then when you start looking into the research on leadership, particularly in schools, you also find that there are lots of different models and lots of different ideas for how to run a school. But again, no clear consensus And the problem with that, as I see it, is that if you don't have a definition of something, you can't test it. So what I found increasingly was that the ideas about leadership were very much dependent on the perspective you took on leadership, and then the studies that were done confirmed or refuted that particular position. And it never really got you any further to understanding how to run a school. And having been running a school for a few years now, it just occurred to me really that none of what I've read was particularly helpful. So I wanted to do my own investigation and sort of find out whether there was anything out there that might help me and other people.
Absolutely. And what I do like, and we'll come to this again later on, but I like the summary of chapter substance at the end, where you talk about, you know, it's almost sort of a you think about Rosenchild's principles of instruction and, you know, recapping and things like that. It's like substance, then the stuff that you need to know, the substance, the significance, and the substance, the validity. And it really did strike me there that it says at the end, despite decades of theorising and research, no consistent definition of leadership has emerged, and no robust theoretical framework which is scientifically testable. So, I mean, when you think about the amount of stuff that, like you said, that's out there about leadership, it really is quite surprising. So, what remains of leadership then?
I'll just add to that.
Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I was just going to add to that, Phil, that having, if you actually look at the last 20, 30 years of research, the word leadership has become really popular as well. We've gone from talking a lot about management through to talking a lot about leadership. And it's become a really popular thing to study. But it is, the term leadership is a bit of a shapeshifter. So whenever you look at it, it seems to be something slightly different and equally in different environments. So if you look at it in education or in business world or other worlds, it looks slightly different. So it just strikes me that leadership is a bit of a chameleon. And every time you look back at it, it looks like something different.
And you think of some of the adjectives used to describe leadership, you know, strong leadership, charismatic leadership, dynamic leadership, you know, lots and lots of different things that, like you said, don't necessarily, aren't necessarily borne out in research or have one clear definition of what leadership is. Okay, so moving from that, next question is around sort of unpicking that a little bit further. So does a belief in generic hollow leadership skills serve as a false set of expertise in a way?
I think, in short, yes. I'm quite critical in the book of the idea of generic leadership skills. And I think that's quite something I've only come to in the last few years, because I think I used to be probably quite a fan of things like trait theory, where you describe the things the great leaders do and what they look like. And I think what changed my mind on it was reading a lot of the cognitive science that's doing the rounds in education at the moment, and how people develop knowledge and expertise, and whether that knowledge and expertise is transferable. So one of the things that I try to pick apart really is, when we look at what great leaders do, can they take those skills and transfer them into a different context? And I think largely it's really difficult to do that. And I think the reason it's difficult to do that is because the way we develop that expertise in the first place. So a lot of our expertise, I've come to believe, is domain specific, which means that we develop our knowledge and skills by doing quite specific things in schools, by leading very specific things and doing particular jobs. And over time, we can develop that expertise and we can make it more flexible, and we can maybe take those skills and use them in other areas. But the development of the skill and the knowledge, I think, comes first, and that transferability comes a bit later. And that's quite different to traditional leadership theory, that sort of suggests that we develop this toolbox of skills and that we're great problem solvers or great communicators, and we can just walk from one situation to another and take that toolbox of skills with us. I don't think that's true. I think it's much more complex than that.
And it's really interesting that you've drawn the parallels with sort of the cognitive science, and you think about, I mean, I listened to a podcast with Craig Barton talking to David Dideout about, you know, the skill of inference in English, for example, and he was talking about this idea that you can't possibly infer something without some knowledge. So actually a lot of the hollow leadership skills that you've talked about here existing in isolation and not, like I said, domain specific, but no one seems to have looked at that yet. So it's a really interesting take on that.
into, you know, these generic leadership skills rather than the knowledge relevant to the leadership role being performed.
Yeah, and I think it's really problematic. I think a lot of the things we see happening recently in education come from this particular misunderstanding. For example, I think leaders become very overconfident in their skills and abilities because they think they've mastered a particular skill, a particular generic skill. And if you think you've mastered something, then there's not much more you need to do to improve it. So I think there's a lot of arrogance maybe that comes from disbelief and also undervaluing actually understanding your context and the specific things that make your school what it is. And if you don't value that context, you stop inquiring and you stop talking to people and you stop finding out more. You sort of become quite fixed in your view of yourself as a leader and that you're good at what you do and therefore there's not much more to learn.
No. Okay, so just moving into chapter three. Now, I don't know if you're a fan of this particular franchise, but by the look of the quote at the beginning of chapter three, you probably are. So I've had the pleasure of watching Star Wars pretty much every one of the nine episodes so far. So I love the quote that starts chapter three, which is, "Do we need clever leaders?" And it's a quote from Obi-Wan Kenobi. Who is the more foolish, the fool or the fool who follows him? So with that in mind, do we need clever leaders and how robust is the evidence in this area?
Yeah, I'm a big fan too, as you could probably tell, although slightly disappointed with the most recent couple of films, but let's not go down that path.
There's an entire different podcast we can do on that one, isn't it?
I'm really open to that as well. So maybe another day. Do we need clever leaders? So, yeah, I suppose it was David Didow's recent book that got me thinking about this one, because I think he doesn't really go much into leadership and intelligence in his book, but because obviously it's about developing intelligence in children. But there's a claim that he makes in the book very briefly that there's this link between intelligence and leadership. And I thought I'd look into that a little bit more. And what I found is that there isn't really much of a link between intelligence and leadership. What is apparent is that people want their leaders to be cleverer than they are, but not too much cleverer. We don't want our leaders to be so clever that we don't understand what they're saying or what they're trying to do. But we do want to have a bit of confidence that they know a little bit more than we do. So we do want leaders to be cleverer than us. But if you look at the evidence of whether that makes a difference to their effectiveness, it's not strong. So I came across a really interesting paper by Ackerman, who talks about this thing called the dark matter of adult intelligence. And it's really an unproven hypothesis, I think, at this point, but really interesting. The idea is that the way we measure intelligence underestimates adult intelligence as we go through life, particularly in relation to people's occupations. And Ackerman makes the claim that because we underestimate domain-specific knowledge in occupations, we think that people get less intelligent as they get older, but actually they probably are getting more intelligent. It's just a different sort of intelligence. It's intelligence related to what we know and the expertise we develop in a particular field of our occupation. So I found it really interesting. So my conclusions from this particular chapter, and actually I published this chapter on my blog if anyone wants to go and look at it without having to buy the book, was really that maybe we need to change the way we view intelligence. And if we change the way we view it, we might actually see that there's a stronger link between intelligence and leadership than we thought.
No, it's a really interesting chapter. And in terms of, you know, you think about the role of a head teacher in terms of selecting your senior leadership team. Is that something that plays a part in the selection of the team around you, those domain-specific skills, the sort of innate or natural intelligence? You know, what are your thoughts on that particular?
I think I've really changed my mind on this, having researched and written the book. So I would have been of the camp of maybe getting different personality styles into the team, getting lots of diversity in terms of people's background experiences and the type of person they are. I think I'm much more minded now to think about what people actually know and what expertise they bring to the mix. So I'm really interested now in making appointments to try to get under the skin of what their experiences are and what they've learned from doing the jobs that they're doing, and trying to get that diversity of knowledge rather than thinking or worrying too much about the generic skills or the personality types that are coming to the team.
Mm. No, it's very interesting. And I said, I've done a little trailer for today's episode in this week's podcast, and I kind of had, and you can't help but do this, have your own lens on reading the book. And this book came at a perfect time for me, because I mentioned on last week's show, you know, I'm about to take a step into deputy headship, so for the first time, having been an assistant head for the best part of 10 years. So it's quite interesting just looking at all this through the prism of I'm about to do some of these things. And this really did change your thinking around what kind of jobs I've had on senior leadership teams, how much domain-specific knowledge I had of doing those at the time. I mean, I think about things like the research school, for example. I knew precious little about academic research or evidence before I started that role, and it was quite a steep learning curve. But now, you know, I've been able to kind of develop such knowledge in that area that it seems a shame almost to let that go, to move into something else. So it really did make me think, this chapter. The whole book did, but particularly this chapter.
Well, that's really good. And I agree with you. I think every time you step into a new role, you do take a few steps backwards, because you realise that all of that expertise you've built up is only partly transferable to the new job that you're doing. So, I agree. Every time I take on a new role, I kind of feel like I'm having to learn very quickly again, just to back out onto an even ground with a new job.
Mm. No, absolutely. So in the chapter on transient turnarounds, you outline some questions that that leaders should be asking teachers right now. So could you share some of these?
Yeah, so I've picked out three, which I think sum up some of the thoughts on this. So the chapter itself is sort of a critique, really, of a certain type of leadership called transformational leadership. And it's this idea that you can go into a school and within 12 or 24 months, rapidly change the school just through force of personality and just that strength of leadership. So it's a bit of a critique of that idea. So some of the questions that I pose there are, first of all, how do you view exam results? Because I think you can look at exam results in two ways. You can look at it as I think I would, which is just a proxy for the quality of education that you've got at the school, and probably not a great proxy if we think about all of the things we want to get out of a child going to school. Exam results are one measure of how successful we've been. So you can look at exam results in that way, or you can look at exam results as an end in themselves. And I think often nowadays in schools, we do seem to think of exam results as being the target, the aim. And you see that in target setting that's done for students, performance management targets, the numbers and the percentages become the thing in themselves rather than the measure of success. So that's the first question I asked, is what is your view of exam results? How do you view those? And what does that tell you about your view of school improvement? The second question I picked out was, would I want to work in a non-leadership position in my school? And this comes from a bit of philosophy, really, which is the veil of ignorance. I think it's, if I remember rightly, John Rawlings who came up with this idea. And it's the idea that if you woke up tomorrow morning and worked in any other job in your school and you had no choice what one it was, would you be bothered by that? So if I woke up tomorrow and I were a cleaner or a teaching assistant or even one of the students in the bottom set of maths, how would I feel about that as an individual? And that's sort of a measure of social justice. It's a measure of whether what you're doing is benefiting people equally and fairly. So I think that's another really good question we should ask ourselves. And then the third one I chose was, has the improvement in my school become unhealthily reliant on my personal effort, charisma and resilience? And this really goes to the heart of transformational leadership ideas, which is that the leader becomes really the centre of the solar system around which everything revolves. And it's quite a dangerous view of leadership, because if you take the leader out of that equation, everything can fall apart. So the big risk with transformational leadership is that the leader becomes so central to school improvement that once that leader leaves, the improvement that's taken place stops happening or rapidly goes backwards. And I think you see that quite a lot in these rapid turnaround schools, where the turnaround isn't sustainable and it's overly dependent on the leader. And then when the leader goes, you're back to square one or maybe even worse. So those are the three ones I picked out for you there, Phil.
And I mean, I wonder how much of those kind of leadership skills are those hollow leadership skills that you talked about at the beginning, you know, almost conflating correlation, causation with exam results, quick turnaround, and plus through the medium of social media and Twitter and things like that, it's very easy to, what's the right word for this, portray your direct influence on, you know, school improvement very, very quickly as a springboard, maybe for the individuals involved as well, at the expense maybe of the whole school itself.
Well, there's a lot of pressure to do that. So I've known of this happening, whereby heads have been drafted into a school, have been given a couple of years, whether that be by the governors or the Mortar Academy Trust or the schools commissioner. They've been given a couple of years to make a rapid improvement in exam results in the trust. And then when they fail, if they fail, they get turfed out. And if they succeed, they may have succeeded, but, you know, sometimes questionable whether that success is sustainable, and whether when they walk away, whether those things are going to remain stable. So it does happen a lot. And I think it is part of the pressure that we are put under now in the school system, which is, you know, a high stakes accountability system, as we are aware.
Mm, absolutely. So in terms of just moving away from that a little bit, how do we lead best in what are, you know, quite difficult and distracting times?
I think it's really hard, because I don't know whether it's harder now to be a head teacher than it used to be, but it certainly feels quite hard because of the pressures that are on us to improve schools and to raise standards and to close gaps and to sort out safeguarding problems and educate children about drugs. All of these things are really, really complex. So I think it's really difficult not to get distracted. So I think I try to do three things on a personal level. So I try, first of all, to fight the fear that goes with Ofsted, which a lot of people I know talk about, but it's really important, I think, as a leader in a school, that you show that Ofsted is one part, possibly a beneficial part in some people's minds of the education system, but it's not something we should fear. And I think we've got to portray that to the staff, to the children, to the parents in the school, that Ofsted is just something that is there and needs to be dealt with. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. I try as much as possible to get contact with students and staff regularly. You know, so I'm not one of those head teachers who likes to sit in my office. I'm really restless. I get bored really easily, which is really good, because it means I go and walk a lot around the school. And I think keeping that contact with students and staff in the school is really good at preventing you getting dragged into paperwork, bureaucracy, accountability systems, meetings, all of the stuff that goes with a leadership position in the school. And the last thing, I think, is to try to reduce that bureaucracy. So when you're in a senior position in school in particular, you have a huge amount of power to either create a lot of paperwork or to actively minimise all of that bureaucracy. So I think we all need to try to constantly fight to reduce the amount of paperwork and bureaucracy in schools, just so that we can all get on with doing the people part of the job, which is the bit that, you know, in the end of it, is going to raise the standards in the school.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And that'll be something that you've seen a lot of people will be nodding their heads to that. And, you know, sometimes you think of the levels of complexity that exist within systems and structures in schools that seem to serve no purpose whatsoever, other than possibly accountability.
Yeah, there are many, many of them. And to be honest, I've brought in loads of those sort of systems over the years myself. So I'm as guilty of it as the next person. So it's certainly not a criticism of school leaders out there. But I think we are getting to a point now where we're realising that probably a lot of those systems don't make a lot of difference to the students.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, in terms of any kind of criticism, this is an extremely positive book. And, you know, it, as the title would suggest, you know, you are very much a leader with substance. Everything that you're suggesting, you know, is uplifting and positive. And, you know, it was a book that, like I said, I picked up and thought this could be something that I'll be turning to quite regularly within the next sort of 6 months to a year of doing this job. Anyway, moving on. I've had some podcasts recently on the curriculum. So I've talked to Martin Robinson about the curriculum. I've talked to Mary Myatt about the curriculum. And you've got a couple of chapters where you've delved into sort of your views on the curriculum. So in chapter 7, what do you mean by curricular genericism?
Well, I can't compete with the two you've just mentioned in terms of knowledge of the curriculum. But I will mention a third one, which is Christine Council, who I do draw upon in the book, who's a particular heroine of mine, I guess, in terms of the curriculum. She's just absolutely brilliant in terms of her thoughts on the curriculum. So I've got to credit Christine, really, for the sort of idea of curriculum genericism. So the idea really is that we tend to easily forget about the distinctiveness of subjects, that they are different entities. And Christine writes very elegantly about this in her blogs. So each of the subjects we got in schools have their particular histories, traditions, ways of doing things. And what we've done in schools over the years is we've overlaid this idea of generic pedagogies, data systems, assessment systems, things that really do violence to the subject distinctiveness. So by overlaying these generic systems, we undermine the teacher's ability, in my opinion, to respect the histories and the traditions of their subject. So I think this is something we're starting to realise as a profession, because I'm seeing a lot of the data systems being stripped back, a lot of the assessments being much more authentic, thanks to people like Daisy Christodoulou, who's written really well about this stuff. So the curriculum genericism really is part, for me, of that wider problem of genericism, that as leaders, we try to bring in a simple system which helps us manage the complexity of the school environment. But in doing so, we're in danger of undermining the quality of education that's being provided. So there's this constant trade-off in leadership in schools of managing complexity and trying to make things simple whilst not oversimplifying and then making people's lives more difficult than they need to be.
So I guess the follow-up to that is then, how do we leave this genericism behind?
Well, I think, first of all, I don't think we will. So having you, you know, saying that the book's really optimistic, which I'm really pleased it is, I think it's always going to be there to an extent because of that dilemma that we've got as a leader. So I think I'm really interested in complexity. I mentioned complexity a bit in the book, but I've been looking a lot more at that since finishing the book. And one of the things that strikes me about schools is they are really, really complex. And the job of a school leader is to try to make sense of that complexity. So I think it's inevitable that school leaders will always try to simplify and find easy ways of trying to achieve school improvement and trying to make the education better for students. And in doing so, inevitably, they're going to do that sometimes in good ways, sometimes in bad ways. So I think this genericism is going to be a constant feature. So in the book, I encourage leaders really to just be on their guard against that tendency, so that when we're doing our thing and making policies and making decisions, we think really carefully about what the impact of those decisions is going to be, and that isn't going to undermine proper educational improvement in the school. And just overlay it with lots of systems and numbers and things that appear to make leaders' lives easier, but probably make everyone else's life harder.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're just going to move on to the chapter on portraying purpose, if that's okay. And you talk about vision. Now, I mean, I'm just going to quote a couple of these because these just really resonated with me. So you talk about compelling visions, and you talk about three different types of visions. So about visions without substance, visions of heroes, and visions not lived. And the visions without substance, I mean, I could probably say this, but I may have to cut it from the podcast later. I'm not sure, I'm pretty sure no one could link this back to the school, and it isn't a direct criticism anyway. But when I started with the Teacher Development Trust Hub, looking at improving CPD across a particular school, and we looked at, you know, what was the vision for the school, and it was exactly as one of yours says there. It was, you know, to be good in I think it was a year, so in a year we'll be a good school, and that was it. And you just think, yeah, right, by doing what, for what purpose, you know, how, yeah, why. So just to unpick, if you can, a little bit for us about the good and bad of vision.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, the one I quote in the book is apparently a real vision statement, which was 2 years to outstanding, and the outstanding being with the capital O, so clearly the Ofsted definition of outstanding. And I think that the problem with vision really is that, well, if we go back to the evidence, there isn't really any evidence that having a compelling vision is a key thing in school improvement. So there's not a lot of solid evidence to support it. And I think the reason for that is not because you shouldn't have a vision. for your school, but I think often visions are done so badly that on average they made little effect. So I'll give you a couple of examples of that. So I think, as I say, one of the mistakes there is visions without substance. So it's choosing a vision for your organisation which really doesn't say anything about real improvement for real people. So things like aiming for an Ofsted grade, or the other one I quote in the book, good is the enemy of excellence, which just fills me with sort of dystopian dread. this kind of idea that doing something good isn't good enough, and, you know, throwing a piece of homework back to a child and saying it's a good piece of homework, but, you know, good is the enemy of excellence. It's not good enough. So I think these kind of visions are fairly hollow and unhelpful. And then I think you've also got the heroic visions where the leader somehow thinks it's their job to dream up the vision for the school, which is not the point of vision at all. The point of vision is to be the magnifying glass for the hopes and the aspirations of all of the people in the community of the school. So I think that's another major mistake that's made, that we somehow think we've got to imagine this city in the clouds that we're going to take everyone to in this heroic fashion. And then the last one, vision's not lived, is that sense you get where a leader stands up and speaks really well about how brilliant the school's going to be, but then doesn't live the values and the vision in any way, so that there's an inconsistency between what they're saying the school is about and then what they actually do. And the problem with that kind of vision is that it undermines the social capital of the organisation, so that the trust between the leaders and the people they are leading over time deteriorates, and it undermines the achievement of that vision. So all of those things are bad examples of visions, and I think probably if you do vision well, it could make a real difference to an organisation. But on average, I think it's probably done in an average to poor way, and therefore what we see in the research is that vision sounds like it's a really good thing, but we're yet to see it making a significant difference.
Mm. And I mean, again, the section at the end where you summarise this, I think is really powerful. So you've put down, school leaders must portray a moral purpose in everything they do. This purpose must be meaningful and worthwhile, one which followers can subscribe and commit to. The education system should be set up to respect the expertise of leaders and teachers if we are to expect our schools to maintain ethical standards. And contrasting that with, you know, literature on school vision and multiple examples of school vision statements pay testament to a corrupt and shallow vision for our education system.
Yeah, and I think one simple example of that is some schools will have a vision which describes how they treat pupils or what amazingly high standards of behaviour they ascribe to, and all of these things which sound really good and look really great on a website. But in reality, when you're confronted with a child who isn't behaving, you and the head of year or the member of staff that you're dealing with, you don't go back to the vision. You go back to quite a simple moral purpose. You're there to help that child understand how to behave appropriately. And that's your shared moral purpose. So I don't think, most of the time, I don't think we need a vision to actually operate in a school environment. What you need is some shared values, a shared moral purpose, and a bit of, you know, basic human understanding, really, about what you're there for.
And another anecdote, which again, I may have to take out, but I don't think, again, that this is particularly upsetting for anybody that's listening to it. A large meeting in a particular town, I've heard this kind of secondhand, where a school that's started to make some quite rapid improvements, by all accounts, by doing things, you know, in the ways that we've talked about here, but have really gone big on a vision for how things should be and how they're going to be the best at this and the best at that, are now trying to get visitors to come and have a look at the school, which is fine. And another school across the table from this particular school, who, you know, has been doing these kind of things for years and years and years, but in a very quiet, unassuming, you know, consistently doing the right things for the children and for the staff. And a meeting between these and other stakeholders, you know, the new sort of school on the block, as it were advocating visits and saying, come along and come and see what we're doing. And the head teacher to the other school just said, yep, we've been doing it for 15 years. Anytime you want to come along, just feel free. You don't need to make an appointment. It was almost sort of contrasting this sort of brash, we're going to do this, we're going to do that vision, with actually living that, you know, in day-to-day reality in the school.
Yeah, and sadly, it's a bit of a macho style of leadership, isn't it? That I think we've imported foolishly from what we believe happens in the corporate world, but I don't think in the corporate world that happens really much at all. But somehow we believe that's the way that we're going to sell our schools to parents. In my experience, that kind of thing just puts parents off, but, you know, I might be wrong.
Mm. And I think that with schools working together, you know, and not competing in sort of a marketplace. I know there's obviously difficulties financially for some schools, particularly in the areas where I'm working, but, you know, schools working together to have a vision for the town or the area is much more beneficial than trying to sort of steal pupils off each other or things like that.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think the market system, again, could be a whole nother podcast, couldn't it? But that probably is at the root of some of those problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're going to move on to your chapter. And I hope I've got this right, Matthew. So it was a chapter on scripts and cultural memes. Now, you know, I'm way too old to be talking about memes.
so am I.
So I was just every time I say a word like this, I hope I don't get it wrong, because I know that an unfortunate member of staff at my previous school, and she won't mind me saying this, who's quite significantly younger than me, used to call them memes. which the kids really quite enjoyed and let her do for months and months and months. Anyway, so just talk about a little bit about what you mean by scripts and cultural memes. And I was particularly struck by the deputy and the NQT with a hands full in the car park.
Yeah, so I'm also too old to really be talking about memes. But there you go, I'm trying to be down with the kids, I guess. But yeah, so my view here is that we all have an operational script in our head that we act to. So we don't constantly think about how we should be behaving. We just run a script. And in certain situations, we behave in certain ways. And I think that's fairly well accepted. I think the connection here then is with what happens at a cultural level in a school. Because if everyone runs their own cultural script in their head in a different way, then you really have no school culture. You have no similarity in the terms of how people behave. So my observation here really is that once people start using similar scripts, behaving in similar ways, then you can observe that in a school and in an organization. So you can actually watch for this sort of thing happening. So one example of that would be, as you say, the example I give of the interaction in car park, which is completely made up, by the way. But what I've done there is I've imagined this interaction whereby this NQT is getting out of their car with a handful of marking, deputy head over the way of the car park, getting out of his car or her car at the same time. And what happens at that point? Do you have a school whereby that deputy head, that senior person, goes across, takes the box for them, offers to give them a hand, has a polite conversation? Or do you work in one of those schools where the deputy thinks, well, you know what, I've got a really stressful day today and I've got a busy meeting and I've got to run off and do something much more important? So these sort of things you can observe in an organisation. And if you've got a strong culture, positive or negative, you should be able to see certain things. I worked in a school once where, and again, this won't be giving anything away because I've worked in too many, but we had a head teacher who really enjoyed getting people into his office and screaming at them quite loudly, usually a few inches from their face. And of course, what those people did is they went out and line managed people in the school in exactly the same way. So there was a school where there were a lot of people shouting at each other. And then inevitably, the teachers who were being shouted at would then go and shout at the kids. And you ended up with this culture in the school whereby the cultural meme was one whereby people shouted at each other when they lost control. And it really came from the top. So the chapter is really about how do you as a leader in a school influence and set the culture and the cultural memes that you want to see happening in the organisation. What can you do to influence those, and how do you change those over time so that you start to shape the culture of the school?
Mm. And although it's a made-up example, I can imagine it's quite a powerful example, and it does set the tone for what kind of interactions are going on inside the building if, you know, the deputy head rushes into the building quickly to kind of get out of the way of any kind of interaction with the staff whatsoever. So, you know, it really was a really powerful example.
Oh, great. That's good.
Okay, so we're moving into the last few questions, if that's okay, and it's on to one that's a particular favourite of the podcast. I know it's a particular favourite of all the team at the Teacher Development Trust. So how important is the Dunning-Kruger effect in leadership?
Well, it is talked and written about quite a lot, isn't it? So obviously, this was something I knew about before I wrote the book, but it really seemed to be the right thing to talk about when I was looking at how we develop our leadership abilities, because it is true that most people think they're better than average in most of the things that they do. And I think one of the barriers for developing leadership is actually accepting some of the things we're not so good at. And therefore, the Dunning-Kruger effect is really, really, is really important for us. So I think in schools, I think it comes about because we're not very good at giving people negative feedback. So people often talk in leadership development programs and not wanting to have difficult conversations, for example. And I think we've got this, I don't know whether it's a British thing, but it's certainly a cultural fear in this country of just saying what we think and saying what we mean. And that's really unhealthy for giving people feedback on their practice. And that doesn't mean we need to be unkind. It's got to be done in a kind way. But actually holding back on that negative feedback is not very helpful. And in particular, it's not very helpful if we're not receiving negative feedback as leaders. So if people don't come to us and tell us when something isn't working because they don't want to damage our ego or get shouted at or whatever it is that they're fearing, then we get this negative cycle, this feedback or lack of a feedback loop in the organization. And the leaders, as leaders, we think that what we're doing is actually working quite well because no one's telling us that it actually isn't. So I think that sort of feeds this idea as leaders that we're better than we think we are. So I think one of the things to overcome that is as a leader, we have to actually go out and seek out feedback, positive and negative. We've got to actively go out and say, I want your honest opinion. Is this doing what it's meant to be doing? And if it's not, what can we do to change it? And that's quite different to the culture you see in a lot of schools in recent years, whereby it's a sort of top-down accountability culture where the job of feedback is for the leader to feedback to the teacher to say, this is how you can improve your teaching, rather than the other way around, with the teacher saying to the leader, this is how we could be improving the school. What about we try it like this? So I think that, again, coming back to culture, there's a sort of cultural thing that prevents us as leaders really having a good handle on whether our schools are as successful as we think they are.
And that's a really interesting point. Again, I'm sorry for listeners that I keep seeing these things through a personal lens, but having been, one of a sizable number of assistant head teachers, as seems to have been the way sort of, for the last decade or so, there's quite often, people ahead of you, above you in seniority, where you can have those conversations. So it'll be quite interesting to move, as you are an experienced head teacher, where do you go for that feedback? And then how does that shape your practice? And that's really interesting reflection for me, just sat there thinking, yeah, actually, from being quite, I mean, micromanaged is the wrong word, but from being quite tightly prescribed the ways that the school does things to now making those decisions for yourself and trying to find avenues to get that feedback. It's really interesting.
And persuading people that you genuinely want that feedback is also really difficult. But particularly, I think, I found that moving into a headship position, people think it's the wrong thing to do to tell you that things aren't great. And as much as you encourage them, they don't think you really mean it. So I think it's really useful. You will get some members of staff who will be brutally honest. And they're often the ones that get pushed away by leaders in schools. But I think they're the ones you need to bring a bit closer because they're the ones who will actually tell you when something isn't working and not be afraid about their career prospects or what you think of them.
No, it's really interesting. So just moving on, kind of a related point there. How do we look to develop the next generation of leaders and what skills should leadership programs look to develop?
Well, you can probably gather from what we've talked about that I'm not a big fan of skill development programs. So I think one of the things we should be doing in leadership programs is teaching them the truth about leadership. And the truth, I think, is that it's in a school environment, it's messy, it's imperfect, it's really complicated or complex, I should say. So I think the first thing we need to do is be honest with people, because I see quite a lot of people coming to senior leadership roles in schools who I'm really surprised by how complex it is. They're used to delivering quite linear plans in fairly controlled environments, and all of a sudden they're doing things which are really imperfect and they can't find solutions for. So I think being true with people, I would say, is the first thing. I would say we need to place more emphasis on expertise and knowledge, which I think is the theme of the book. So rather than worry too much about whether we've got the right communication or problem-solving skills, that we actually know what we're talking about. So we study, we research, we read, we talk to people, we understand our school, and we understand the context properly, I think that's really undervalued in the leadership programs, certainly that I've experienced in the past. And then lastly, I think we need to talk to them more about problems. So I'm going to give a plug here to Ambition Institute, who I know are doing some great work in this area, with a sort of what they call a persistent problems approach to leadership development. And I think this is really valuable. It's because leadership is about solving problems, first and foremost, and the knowledge and the expertise you need to solve those problems. So we need to talk a little bit more in our leadership programs and development about what those problems are, and what different ways there are to solving them, and what works and what doesn't work in different contexts. So I would advocate a much more grounded approach, which is based on our everyday experience in schools, rather than an overly theoretical skills-based approach.
No, I would agree with you in terms of the ambition stuff, and we're fortunate in Blackpool to have, you know, quite a lot of dealings with ambition, and, you know, I'm fortunate enough to be leading on part of their sort of leadership coaching, instructional coaching model. So absolutely, you know, when I started with that, and it was very much, you know, situation based, what would you do in this situation, how would you do it, here's the best things to try in this particular area, practice this, you know, coach this. It was really quite different, but, you know, the people who've been on the course have found it really, really beneficial.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Okay, now this is probably the last couple of questions literally now, but this phrase, I just thought this is fantastic, and I thought I might get this put up. I know that we talked before about vision statements, that you should live, not laminate, but I thought this particular phrase really, really struck me. So in the Indicators of Change chapter, why should school leaders have their finger on the pulse and not the trigger?
I'm glad you like that, Phil, because that was my favourite soundbite, actually, of the book. I thought I might get a badge of it too. So I think there's an irony in schools, really, which is that we have this high stakes accountability culture, where we are held to account by people from outside of our organisations to really high standards, but quite rightly high standards. But it's a high stakes culture. People lose their jobs if they don't get it right, and we tend to pass that down on schools into our schools and into the way we manage people. But I think the problem is, the irony of it is, the higher the accountability culture, the less useful information we get about people making mistakes. So it goes back to this idea of knowing what's going wrong in the organization. And people will hide their mistakes, particularly in the classroom, if you make them too fearful of admitting them. So the irony of that is that leaders get out of touch with their organizations. And the response to being out of touch with your organization is to increase the amount of scrutiny and monitoring that you do, because you see the mistakes are happening, but you don't realize they've happened until you get the results at the end of the year and you know, everything's not as good as you thought it was going to be. So I talk a bit in the book about lagged indicators. It's just the economist coming out of me, really. But exam results are after the event, and it's too late to do anything with that as an indicator of failure or success. So what we need to do as leaders is keep our finger on the pulse. In other words, we need to look for the indicators of what's going well now, before things go well or badly. So it's a change of view. It's being less reliant on things like the statistics, the exam results, and the formal measures that we use in schools, and being a bit more aware of what is just going on every day in the school, which again means you've got to be out and about, you've got to be talking to people, you've got to be observing very carefully what's happening in the school. And if you do that, you're much more likely to see when things aren't working the way they should be. And if you can spot it early, you can do something about it, and then you don't get this knee-jerk reaction later, looking for someone to blame and increasing the amount of scrutiny and accountability that you put back into the school.
No, definitely. And that's definitely going to be one of the key takeaways for me in terms of being out and about, finger on the pulse, not on the trigger. So it just remains to say, before we get into the last little section, just thank you so much for your time over the holidays. And can I just apologise to you and the listeners for, you know, I'm kind of very aware of the Dunning-Kruger effect in my performance. I literally haven't spoken to anybody for a couple of days. So I've been having a full rest, and it shows. So, yes, apologies for being a little bit rusty on the questions, but I think that your answers have been fantastic. So I'm sure that won't take anything away from listeners' enjoyment of the podcast. Just before we go, can I just ask you a little bit about where you're going to be out and about speaking about this book in the next few months, and where listeners can find a little bit more in terms of maybe your website or where they can pick the book up from?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Twitter, as is everyone nowadays, it seems. So you can find me with the, whatever you call it, @head_teach is my tag on there. And my blog is educontrarianblog.com, as in education contrarian, which is more or less what I am. And yeah, I'm speaking at a couple of conferences coming up in the new year. So I'm going to be at the Research Ed conferences in Cardiff on the 29th of February and Birmingham on the 7th of March. And I think I'm probably going to be talking about some of the stuff in the book, but also some of the stuff on complexity that I was talking about earlier, which I've been doing a lot of research and reading into, and may even form the basis of a second book, possibly. You've heard that here first.
Oh, another Nailers Natter exclusive. They just keep coming on this podcast, so that's fantastic. Well, I am going to be in Research Ed Birmingham as well, so there's one of my workshops sorted, so I'll put a tick next to that one, and I'll come along and meet you in person. And hopefully before that, I'll have made sure I've had some adult conversation, just been talking to two kids for the last how many days, and I might actually make some sense. But yeah, thanks so much, Matthew. Thanks for your time. Really appreciate it tonight, and I look forward to hopefully seeing you in Birmingham.
Thanks, Phil. It's been great to be on, and see you soon.
Thank you.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Teacher Development Trust Section, learning from the team at TDT on best practice CPD with research.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Hi, this is Bethan Hindley from the Teacher Development Trust with my colleague Polly Butterfield Tracy, wishing you a very happy new year, Phil, and we have some exciting news to start the year off. So we've been developing a new programme around pedagogical coaching, which is launching later this year. So we wanted just to share some insights from our development day that we've been doing. So first of all, starting off with what pedagogical coaching is. It's a high impact direct form of professional development where teachers work with a trained pedagogical coach to set goals to improve their pupil outcomes. The coaches then carry out focused observations and swiftly share non-judgmental and developmental feedback to move coaches towards meeting their goals. Pedagogical coaching is dialogic, developmental, and it happens in an ongoing cyclical manner. It's based on a partnership of equals, and the goals are co-decided. So the teachers and the coaches both have input in clarifying and setting those goals. So we've piloted this training with schools in both phases, which is supporting us now as we move to launch this course. So Polly, what takeaways have there been from the first session of pilots?
I think there's been two big takeaways. Certainly, for me, what I've noticed in working in schools and my own experience of introducing coaching in a secondary school is that it's incredibly powerful when you're working with a coachee to have explicit permission from them about what they want you to focus on. So what specific area of practice it is that they are happy for you to look at. And also what areas they're not happy for you to look at. That's powerful because, as a result, those observations are forensic. They're often very short, 10 or 15 minute observations, but they are absolutely targeted on what you have that explicit permission to look at. Another big takeaway for me is the buy-in from staff through this pedagogical model. As Bethan mentioned earlier, because the goal is co-decided and there is that relationship of equals, there's absolute buy-in from staff. They don't feel things are done to them, that they feel a part of the process, and as a result the trust between the coach and the coachee develops really naturally and effectively.
Brilliant. So we're very excited to start the decade off with this new training offer, and we'll be sharing more information in the February TDT newsletter. So back to you in the studio, Phil.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast Pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast Pedagogy, listening to teachers.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
So this week I've been reading Lowborn by Kerry Hudson, growing up and returning to Britain's poorest towns. And I chose this book as a child myself of working class parents raised in Thatcher's Britain. And I wanted to really understand the complexities of being born working class in Britain, as Jack Monroe states in the book's introduction.
So, I was drawn to this book to engender empathy for the situation our most vulnerable families find themselves in the current times. So, Lowborn, which began as a column in a no longer available website, namely The Pool, is divided into the author's memories of growing up and her more recent experiences of returning to the places which formed part of her life. And the author's childhood consisted of a transient hop around the east coast of the UK, in which she went to 9 primary and 5 secondary schools. And Kerry's life was defined by her mother's difficult relationships and personal life and her struggles with mental illness. Kerry is now a very successful author and has written 2 novels, namely Tony Hogan Bought Me an Ice Cream Float Before He Stole My Ma and Thirst. So whilst this book didn't really help me to understand the complexities of being born working class in Britain, it did give me an insight into life at the extremities, as particularly as Kerry summed it up, the extremes of the world's 6th richest economy, where 1/5 of people are living in poverty. And Kerry gives austerity and a crumbling welfare state a damning indictment, with help even harder to come by in 2020's Britain. But all in all, it's an upbeat portrayal of survival and the artistic flourishing of the author, and I heartily recommend reading this book. So Lowborn, Growing Up, Getting Away and Returning to Britain's Poorest Towns is published by Chatto. Okay, so this week I'm looking at other things that I've been getting up to over the Christmas break, and we're quite big fans in the Naylor household of going to the cinema, thanks mainly to the fact that we've got quite a reasonably priced independent cinema quite close to us, so it's not an expensive hobby. Anyway, the film that we went to watch this week, we went to watch Spies in Disguise, starring Will Smith and Tom Holland, and this was a really good, fun animation. So the basic plot, or my summary of the basic plot, is Will Smith as Lance Sterling, a suave and sophisticated secret agent working with a geekier, young sort of secret agent Beckett, which is Tom Holland, sorry, Walter Beckett, which is played by Tom Holland, who is, for the older listeners amongst you, Q to Will Smith's Bond. And Walter has invented as a child an inflatable hug and a party popper glitter kitten, which are deployed to dazzle the enemy instead of weapons. So the laughs start particularly when Lance is turned into a pigeon. I won't ruin the plot too much to say how that happens. And as they say, they, you know, that you learn something every day. So who knew that number 1s and 2s come out of the same orifice in pigeons? So you find out the name of that, and it provides quite a lot of humour through the film. So the script and the plot are the usual to and fro, but they have some stunning backdrops of Venice and Washington. So overall, a good family fun film and some good old-fashioned entertainment there as well. So that's Spies in Disguise, and that's out now. Also, on the theme of sort of broadening our horizons a little bit, I'm going to do a little bit of a section on music. Obviously, for copyright, we can't play any of the music, but I'm just going to give you an insight into what we're currently listening to here in Naylor's Natter HQ. So, I'm probably too old for this, and I'm definitely not cool enough for this, but thanks to Child One's Guitar Obsession, I was drawn to the Scottish singer-songwriter Jerry Cinnamon. So a quick Google search started well. He's got mutual love of 90s Britpop, Oasis, likes Adidas trainers and Parkers, so he's all right with me. And he also loves the Cortinas as well. So yes, we're quite big fans of those. So he does seem to have gone a little bit under the radar, and he's not on the front page of any magazines or newspapers that I know of. But he seems to be a bit of a word-of-mouth sensation and a bit sort of analogue in a digital world. So I ordered, as I would do, the red vinyl of his album, Erratic Cinematic. So some of the content is best avoided if you're taking a family car journey, but the tunes, to use Jerry's phrase, are absolute belters and a real antidote to the January blues. So if you're interested in a running playlist, then I can heartily recommend Erratic Cinematic by Jerry Cinnamon, and that's available everywhere now. So moving into the shameless plugs for this week, and we continue to have shameless plugs for both the Research Eds taking place in March. So we have Research Ed Birmingham and we have Research Ed Blackpool. So if you've got tickets for those, lucky you. If you haven't, I believe there are waiting lists for both of those which you can add yourselves to, or just follow all the events on Twitter. Also, shameless plugs for Brew Ed Aussie on the 1st of February. So I was speaking about curriculum, I think, on that one. So yes, come along and support that. I think there's a couple of tickets left for that. You can still get those via the Eventbrite site. Also, shameless plugs for Brew Ed Science, which looks to be a fantastic event, and I believe that has sold out now. So some great speakers, as I mentioned before. Previous guest Louise Lewis will be speaking at that. So if you're interested in finding out what Louise will be speaking about, then you can look at her back catalogue podcast, or you can just come along to Brew Ed Science. And also, I said at the beginning that I would mention the website Fiverr. So Benjamin D. Barker of Team Science, who actually put me on the path to podcasting with some of the Team Science podcasts that he did a year or so ago now, also put me into sort of the ideas of using Fiverr website. So Benjamin has blogged about how to do this, but if you check out the Fiverr site, basically, I think I'm right in saying this, it's kind of an eBay for sort of artistic entrepreneurs. So the jingles that we use on Nail Is Natter podcast came through there, and again, through recommendations that Benjamin had given to me. But also, if you're looking to do presentations for school or presentations for open nights or things that maybe require a little bit more time than maybe we've got, or perhaps some extra expertise, and what you will find is that they're pretty reasonably priced, they're really good high quality materials. So if you haven't seen the website Fiverr, check that out, and again, you know, let me know what your thoughts are on that. But I was very happy with the service I've had. I had the original jingle plus the two new jingles that we've got now on there, and I'm really, really happy with those, so check that out. Okay, speaking of giving us your thoughts, so I'll be very interested in your feedback, particularly on the new sections, whether that's something that we want to look into, so the podcast pedagogy section, so sticking with the reading of the books, but if you're interested in some of the other stuff, then let me know and send a message via the Anchor app, or simply send an email via the website, so it's nailersnatter.co.uk. So next week, really, really excited to have Matt Pinkett on to talking about Boys Don't Try. I've already recorded that interview, and Matt really got me opening up and talking probably more than I've done in any of the podcasts so far. So really looking forward to sharing that one with you. It's a fascinating book. It's a fascinating interview. So that's coming up on next week's podcast. Just remains to say, as ever, thank you very much for listening to Nail Is Natter, and see you next time.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.